From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Activists are hustling to convince voters to change Michigan's constitution, restructuring income taxes. We'll talk about that first this hour. Also, as primary election March Madness continues, we'll hear how environmental issues stack up among the Democratic contenders for president.
Since the presidential debate in Detroit last summer, the issues have amped up quite significantly because during that debate, not a question was asked about the Great Lakes.
And we speak with a political journalist who's been talking with Arab American and Muslim American voters supporting Bernie Sanders.
A theme that emerged was the justice aspect. This is a man who calls for justice, and Islam calls for universal values of justice, so we are backing him.
All that's coming up and much more on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later today on the program, the unique perspective of Arab American and Muslim American voting blocs in Michigan. But first, late last week, a group called Fair Tax Michigan filed petition language with the Secretary of State's office to begin a ballot drive for a graduated income tax. The group's made up of Democratic activists. They'd like to ask voters for a constitutional change that would end the state's flat tax and replace it with a tiered income tax system. Here to talk about what that means is Eli Isagiri, campaign manager for Fair Tax Michigan. Eli, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me, April.
What would this change?
Yeah, so we're looking at moving our system to a more fair tax. So anyone that makes under $175,000 a year would see some tax relief, and folks making over $175,000 for individuals and $350,000 for joint earners would pay a little bit more, just to make sure we have the resources needed in Michigan to fund things that we need, our schools and our infrastructure and water.
Do you have an estimate on how much money this would raise for the state?
So the language says that it would need to come up with about $1.5 billion in new funding for the state, and that would go directly to schools and for our infrastructure, including water infrastructure.
Why does your group feel that this particular approach, a graduated tax, is the best way?
Yeah, so more states than not have a graduated income tax, and with us, in the state of Michigan, seeing we have less money year over year to fund the things that really make our state competitive, it's one of the solutions that we found needs to move forward. The legislature in Lansing has refused to take a serious stab at fixing this problem, and folks across the state are just really fed up. And until we have real movement, we know that our schools will continue to be underfunded, and we'll have more problems with PFAS and lead in the water across the state.
Anyone who's ever lived in a state with a graduated tax can tell you that they don't exactly end battles over state funding for priorities. What makes you think that this is going to be an improvement on the way some of the big infrastructure issues like roads and clean water are handled right now?
We know we need about $3.7 billion more per year to adequately fund our schools and, repair the worst roads in the nation. And we see, this continual problem with our water. So this won't go completely there to fix the almost $4 billion hole that our funds need, but this is a strong step in the right direction. And, folks in Flint and, across the state dealing with PFAS, they know that the government in Lansing is not doing anything to actually fix these problems. And so this is a real solution that really can have a huge impact on the state.
Do you expect that there would be a risk of turning out Republicans or at least fiscal conservatives in a year when turnout will be key for things like the presidential contest?
Well, I think we're seeing over and over across the state communities step up to fund issues locally where the state and federal government have failed. So I don't think that would be a core driver to bring people out. I think more importantly, folks will see this as a solution to some longstanding problems, and more folks are ready for real change. And we're kind of sick and tired of waiting for those in Lansing to come up with a solution when they just want to fight instead of coming up with real tangible solutions that can lead to better outcomes with our roads and our education system.
Are you at all concerned that the legislature might come in and change what you've written?
Not really, no. It's written out that the legislature would have time to move forward with a bill, and if they do not, then the governor would be allowed to move something through executive order. So, this really makes our state legislature do the job that we've sent them to Lansing to do. And again, if they're unwilling to come up with a solution like they have been for the last 10 years, 15 years, then the governor can actually do something. And so, we think this is a real solution.
Well, there is some precedent for the legislature passing something and then amending it. What's to stop them in this case?
To stop them is a governor with a backbone right now. We saw what happened last time with one party controlling the entire process. And, thankfully, that is not the situation we're in right now.
Eli Isagiri is the campaign manager for Fair Tax Michigan. Eli, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me, April.
Let's get a little context now on how we arrived where we are with the state's tax structure. We turn to Charles Ballard, professor of economics at Michigan State University and sometime commentator on economic issues for Stateside. Hey, Charlie.
Glad to be here.
Why does Michigan have a flat tax?
Well, it's written into the 1963 Constitution. We are one of seven states that have a flat income tax where every dollar of taxable income is taxed at the same rate. That rate is currently 4.25%. There are 36 states that have a graduated income tax, like the federal government's graduated income tax, where the rate on an additional dollar of taxable income increases as you go up the income scale. It's a matter of history, and I guess it was the result of discussions among the people in the Constitutional Convention back more than a half a century ago.
So what was going on in Michigan at the time that made the constitutional change seem like a good idea?
Well, I was in fourth grade at that time, and I didn't live in Michigan at that time, so I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I think it would come out of the same political trade-offs that have led to graduated income taxes in some other states and flat taxes in other states. I mean, it has to do with the political power of those who want a less progressive system versus the political power of those who want a more progressive system. And also, people's views about the trade-off. If you make a more progressive system, there is the possibility that you would have more disincentives to have different types of economic activity. I think those within the range that we're talking about for what the rates might be, those are relatively small, but it's a legitimate concern to think, higher rates on more affluent people might discourage some kinds of activity. So I think it probably came out of that trade-off between values about how unequal or equal the income distribution should be versus other considerations.
What's the history of the state's relationship with this? Can you recap whether there's been a serious push in modern history to reconsider the way tax rates are figured?
Oh, yes. There have been discussions for years about the possibility of a graduated income tax. What we have in Michigan, since the sales tax is somewhat regressive, we have a tax system that is overall regressive. In other words, it takes a higher percentage of income from the low-income people. And given that the massive increase in income inequality is one of the biggest features of our lifetime, not only in Michigan but across most of the United States, people are concerned about finding ways to even things out to make it better for those at the bottom of the scale. And there have been lots of discussions. Now it looks like we're going to have an actual ballot initiative. But it's been on the public policy back burner for decades.
There have been times in this country when people like Steve Forbes have argued with varying degrees of success for a national flat tax with the understanding that it would simplify the federal tax code considerably. And yet here Michigan is on the cusp of a discussion about creating more nuance and arguably more complication in the system. Are there economic reasons why a more complex tax system is considered of benefit to a healthy economy?
I want to draw a distinction between the graduated rate structure and complexity. Many folks, including Steve Forbes, they would tout their proposals for a flat tax in terms of reducing the complexity. But most of the complexity In fact, almost all of the complexity of the federal tax system has nothing to do with the fact that we've got graduated rates. It has to do with the fact that we've got various exemptions and exclusions. And each of those exemptions and credits and deductions has an army of lawyers and lobbyists fighting for it. And so it's not at all clear that we could get rid of all of that complication. It would be nice if we did. But that's a kind of a separate issue from the graduated rate structure. I think we could adopt a graduated rate structure in Michigan with only minuscule changes in the complexity. Because basically, instead of having one number, you would just have a tax table like you have in the federal at the federal level. And a lot of it would go through a computer anyway if you're doing your taxes through TurboTax. So it would not increase, would not have to increase the complexity of the tax system.
Is there any reason to think that Michiganders of means who wish to have the most advantageous tax plans possible might not find some way around it if the state did change its structure?
Well, often it's suggested that some affluent Michiganders may leave the state. I think it's possible that some will. The question is how many. I think that those numbers would be relatively small. I remember once I was at an event where a speaker who was against a graduated income tax said that if we had that, affluent people would leave the state. And I said, so, Rich, does that mean that if we adopt it, you would move? And he said, no, that, I would not move. So I'm not sure how big the effect is. It's something to think about. I will tell you that my wife and I have been blessed enough to be relatively well off, and we would pay more under a graduated tax. However, we're not planning to move. So I think different people would respond in different ways.
Well, the federal and state tax systems are different beasts with different goals.
Yes, although one way in which the state of Michigan takes advantage of the federal system is that we sort of piggyback you. The start for your federal for your state income tax is your adjusted gross income from the federal. So we simplify things in that way. But when a billionaire says, "Let's have the flat tax," and says, "Oh, it'll simplify things," I'm thinking, well, yes, and it would also dramatically reduce the tax liability of billionaires. So there may have been just a touch of self-interest in the Forbes proposal.
Charles Ballard is a professor of economics at Michigan State University. Coming up, Michigan's businesses call for common sense reform on immigration issues. Is it possible in an election year? Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Immigration policy has been one of the most brutally fought political battles of the last decade. Michigan's business groups and others recently signed a Michigan Immigration Compact that calls on common sense reforms. It's almost hard to remember what that might mean, but for many families and businesses, the stakes for immigration policy are still very high. With us to talk more about the compact is Andy Johnston, Vice President for Government and Corporate Affairs with the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, April.
And Steve Tobachman, a former state representative and founder and executive director of Global Detroit. Steve Tobachman, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having Andy and I.
What does the compact call for? Can you explain a little bit further what we mean when we say a common sense approach to immigration issues?
Sure. I mean, first, I think the compact recognizes that this is a federal responsibility. There's a lot we need to do to improve the system, and we're calling on the congressional delegation to work to enact immigration policies that improve the system, keep our community safe, protect our borders, and facilitate trade. It also highlights, you know, the economic benefit and how Michigan needs robust workforce policies that prioritize attracting and retaining international talent. It calls for the sensible path forward, you know, reflecting, you know, these long-established values and also the critical role that immigration has played in our history and our economy so that we can move forward for those who want to contribute, those of good character who pay taxes and are committed to becoming fully participating members of our society. We also want more of a stable regulatory environment. And we're doing it because we really view that if we get this right, it will only be to our competitive advantage.
Steve, what sectors would you say have been hit hardest by the immigration crackdowns or even just the slowdowns that we've seen in recent years?
It's really across the board, because what happens when even we settle, say, fewer refugees in our communities, we see that there's less spending going on. When there are less international students attending our colleges and universities, it has a twofold impact. One, it decreases the amount of spending that goes on in our university communities for room and board and for tuition that help keep tuition rates low for Michiganders. But it also chokes off that supply of high-skilled STEM talent. And so it's a huge impact across the board, but particularly in areas of STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, those high-tech jobs, advanced manufacturing jobs, but also we see it in agriculture and our service industries as well.
Andy, what do you see the immigration slowdown meaning for Michigan small businesses? I mean, what does this look like in Grand Rapids?
Yeah, I mean, with some of the issues with refugees, that was particularly concerning to us because, you know, over the past decade, we've hired 3,500 refugees across a number of businesses here in the area. So that's a real concern, again, when, you know, workforce and talent shortages are the number one issue we hear time and time and again for our members. That's critical. But for small businesses, it can also impact small business growth, because oftentimes new Americans are the risk takers, those willing to start new businesses, often Main Street businesses, and we need to continue that important entrepreneurial activity.
Is it a tough sell to ask elected officials of either party, really, to stand up and support the reforms that you're asking for, given the nationalist wave that swept President Trump into office? I mean, moderate Republicans have certainly been primaried for less.
I think the most significant thing, the biggest thing we need is a comprehensive change on this outdated system that we've been living with for decades. But we're trying to bring, you talk about the messaging, we're trying to bring the data that can hopefully alleviate those concerns so we can focus on what the real impact is. And also remind folks that the story of Michigan, the story of, you know, the United States, has been immigrants coming here and greatly contributing to the success of our country and our state. And that's why people can find a lot of this data at mycompact.org and hopefully make decisions for themselves. And our goal is going to be to educate our delegation on that new Americans contribute more in taxes than they take out in safety net services. You know, those are the kinds of data points that I think are helpful for people making the right decisions.
I think that immigration can be a winning issue politically, and I think it is. It's just the right tone on immigration. And so there's lots of polling to suggest that the American public does not want to see kids in cages, does not want to see families separated at the border, does not want to see raids on good, hardworking people. At the same time, they are concerned about their economic future and don't favor unfettered immigration and no border security whatsoever. And so it's, I think the compact is in line with where the American people want to go, and that immigration, which is now polling as the number one issue for all kinds of demographic groups in the presidential election. So this is an issue that people can't run from, that getting the right tone, one that is comprehensive, as Andy says, that fixes a broken immigration system, that creates economic opportunity for Americans and create legal pathways for those who want to pursue the American dream, is a necessary component of anybody running for federal office at this point.
Is it more difficult to break through on this issue at a time when many economic indicators, the coronavirus stock roller coaster notwithstanding, is it difficult to break through on this issue when many economic indicators are looking pretty strong?
I would say that what we've seen across Michigan and across the Midwest and the Rust Belt in general is a recognition by chambers of commerce, by economic development practitioners, and by state and local officials of both parties, whether it was Rick Snyder here in Michigan or John Kasich in Ohio, that welcoming immigrants and bringing them into the community in ways that create jobs and create opportunities is a winning issue. And you're seeing more and more local electeds and more business groups and more people say that we need common sense immigration reform and being willing to stand up. So my experience over the last decade state at Global Detroit is that we've seen an increasing number of folks who normally haven't been advocating on immigration coming to the table and saying, we want America to be a prosperous country. And we recognize that here in the Midwest, immigrants have been enormous contributors, have been the source of all our population growth, our starting companies, our vibrant sources of entrepreneurship, and are the workforce that we need to meet an aging workforce in a state that's having a hard time attracting young talent from outside the state.
Well, just to build off what Steve's saying, I mean, you know, the Grand Rapids Chamber was excited to help bring together this really diverse coalition of business and industry leaders, and I think that really speaks to the need that's out there and how imperative it is that we and our legislators all understand how drastically immigration impacts our economy. One of the messages we'd love to get out is that if you and your organization want to sign on to the compact to add your company's name to the growing chorus of folks calling for comprehensive immigration reform, you can sign on to the compact as well at mycompact.org.
I would just add that the compact represents a watershed moment in my mind of Michigan's business community stepping to the plate and saying that they want to be heard on immigration. The chambers of commerce, the groups like Business Leaders from Michigan, Small Business Association of Michigan, the Farm Bureau, and others represent over 20,000 companies and over a million jobs here in this state. And they have said loud and clear that immigration is an important economic issue, and it's important to the future prosperity of Michiganders.
Steve Tobachman with Global Detroit and Andy Johnston of the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you, April.
If you'd like more information on the Michigan Immigration Compact, you can find a link on our website. When we talk about environmental issues, are we talking about just the land? Most people would tell you they also have to do with our ideas about the economy and public health. Sometimes they can inform how we think about infrastructure or just quality of life. As we get closer to Michigan's primary on March 10th, we wanted to think a bit more about the Democratic candidates for president, their records and platforms on Great Lakes issues, and other environmental concerns that Michiganders care about. Lisa Wozniak is executive director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. She joins us now. Lisa, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Are many of the candidates speaking in overt terms about environmental issues at this stage?
Well, since the presidential debate in Detroit last summer, I would say that the issues have amped up quite significantly because during that debate, not a question was asked about the Great Lakes. Climate change barely came up. You're right. I think that they've heard loudly and clearly from voters across this country that those two issues, especially in this region, with 90% of the fresh water in our country defining who we are, that those are very important issues, and they better be talking about them if they want to garner the votes of Michiganders or people within this region.
I have a question about this, because when you follow what happens in a presidential election year, you see the candidates moving from state to state following the primary chase and suddenly speaking very specifically about very specific issues, say, in Michigan that might not make sense in Montana. How do you triangulate what is said on the campaign trail and how we should hold candidates accountable at a time when they're trying to get votes?
Well, I think they've seen pretty clearly in a number of states that it's both climate and water. And the closer you get to these large water bodies called the Great Lakes, the more significant that becomes. And certainly in a state like Michigan, where we've been doing a lot of testing for something that's called PFAS, a very dangerous toxin.
Just to explain, that's the class of chemicals that do not break down in the environment and which have been found very prominently in several Michigan bodies of water, especially around the former Wirt Smith Air Force Base.
That's correct. Anywhere that we've actually had firefighting foam, anywhere we've had significant electroplating facilities. Well, in Michigan, we've had a lot of those. And we've also, in the Snyder administration, been testing, starting in under Snyder's administration, testing more than any other state in the country. So we have a lot of identified sites in this state for PFAS. We also are the home, unfortunately, for the lead crisis that happened in Flint, Michigan. So in Michiganders' minds, it is a plethora of things that are confronting our water, making them very concerned about whether or not they can actually turn on their tap and give their child or their aging parent or their pregnant spouse a glass safely. So it's a water crisis and it's a climate crisis. And in a state like Michigan, those two things come together.
Is it enough for a candidate to say that they are concerned about PFAS, as, for example, we've seen Joe Biden doing in a town hall situation? Or are you asking for a more direct action plan, as candidates like Elizabeth Warren have laid out?
We're asking for explicit plans, and we're actually asking for details on what they're going to do on day one, if elected, to address both these crises, the water crises and the climate crises. And in Michigan, recent polling has shown that not a number one issue, but the number one issue on and people's minds and Democratic primary voters' minds is safe, clean drinking water free of toxins. So as the candidates come here more often, which they're going to do very soon, they are going to be confronted in every community that they stop in about these issues. And I would bet that they're going to be more and more explicit about what their plans are.
By the league standards, which candidate is being the most specific about their plans to clean up water pollution at this point?
Good question. I would say all the candidates have explicit plans on climate. They've become more and more detailed. Elizabeth Warren took some of Jay Inslee's plan when he dropped out of the race, for example, and they've become more and more interested in talking about water the more time they spend in Michigan. So their plans vary, but you've seen a number of candidates stop in the 48217 zip code, which is the most polluted zip code in our state, to have conversations with people about what is burdening their water, their air, the land. A few candidates have come out and spoke out against Line 5, the pipeline that runs beneath the Straits of Mackinac, because frankly, that is an issue that sits at the intersection of climate and water. It's a huge threat to the drinking water of millions of people and the health and safety of our Great Lakes. It's also aging fossil fuel infrastructure. So I would say that the more time they spend in Michigan, the more they talk to people here, the more they understand they absolutely must have strong plans on both fronts.
In 2016, Bernie Sanders won the Democratic primary in Michigan, surprising a lot of people and providing what turned out to be a pretty prescient upset of Hillary Clinton's campaign at that stage of the Democratic primaries. How does Senator Sanders rate by league standards?
You know, all of the candidates that are running right now actually have strong records, some of them more overt because they've served in places like the U.S. Senate. They have strong records on protecting our environment. And there are some people who have never served at the federal level, so there's not a tracking of them. I would say right now it's a challenge to each of them. It's a race to the top to be the best and the boldest in these plans because, frankly, the health and safety of certainly Michiganders, but I would argue the nation and the world depends on what they're going to do to address these issues.
We're running into a situation where, with PFAS regulation, where the United States government is both the most likely regulator and the party with potentially the most liability, since the U.S. military has been such a big consumer and user of PFAS chemicals. In a situation like that, how do you get candidates to commit to changes?
Well, you just take a look at what our current elected officials from the state of Michigan have been doing to actually hold the Department of Defense accountable. They have been very bold in their language around the importance of cleaning up Wordsmith Air Force Base. Senator Peters and Congressman Kildee and Congresswoman Dingell, Congresswoman Slotkin, they have been very clear that it is absolutely the responsibility of the Department of Defense. And for someone like Alyssa Slotkin, who has served in security arenas, she is very clear that the bodies that are responsible for defending our nation are should very much be responsible for protecting the health and safety of our citizens and certainly the veterans who have served our country. They are literally being poisoned by the lack of cleanup on these facilities, not only here in Michigan, but across the country.
At the same time, senators of standing like Debbie Stabenow have not been able to get the kind of immediate forceful action on legislation that she has proposed. Can we think that under a different administration, things would be any different?
I think they would for two reasons. One is that this issue is only growing in its importance and in its saliency around this country. There are some states that don't have PFAS in their vernacular like Michigan does. And as that becomes more and more apparent in states across the country, it is not just happening in blue states or red states or purple states. It's happening in all states. And the people of this nation are going to stand up in greater and greater numbers and demand action.
What would you say to a voter who's going to vote in the Democratic primary, but who's thinking, I know who's in line with the issues that I care about, But I also want to elect someone who's got some staying power through this fall and to November in the general election. Can we say environmental issues and specifically Great Lakes regional water issues are going to be key at that point?
Absolutely. I have worked in this arena for many years. The word environment and environmental has some saliency with a certain portion of our population. If you talk about public health, if you talk about the safety of our children, if you talk about the future of our state's economy, these are issues that are ubiquitous. They're not, quote unquote, just environment. They are about the health and safety of our citizens, and I believe they're going to remain incredibly top tier. If the early polling that we've done is any indication, safe, clean drinking water free of toxins was not only important in 2018 when we saw what I call a clean water wave that took over the state with candidates up and down the ballot being elected. It is even more salient in 2020. Citizens are going to demand from their candidates that this remain a top tier issue, and it will.
What's difficult about connecting the local perspective on public health and drinking water issues to the national lens, which also includes issues like health care and foreign policy and gun legislation?
When it becomes a kitchen table conversation, that means that the issue has become something that people are going to vote on. They're going to talk to their neighbors about. They're going to be speaking about it in community gathering spaces, whether they're churches and synagogues or mosques. This is an issue that is just as salient, if not more salient, than the issues that you've just mentioned.
Lisa Wozniak is the executive director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
If you'd like to read more about how the League has been talking to voters about issues in primary season, you can find a link on our website. There's a new survey that looks at climate and water among top priorities for Democratic primary voters in Michigan. In the battle for primary votes, Michigan's Arab American voters are among those getting a lot of attention.
A community like ours, which has been seen traditionally as toxic to any political campaign, now we are being seen as an asset.
We'll hear how that's been playing out after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It may seem as though the Michigan primary is still weeks away. Rest assured, contenders in the Democratic presidential primary are sweating that shrinking window that remains to try to win you over. And if you happen to be Arab American, you may have noticed the senator from Vermont is picking up some love on social media and among key voters. Bernie Sanders, picking up steam on Twitter as Amu Bernie, has been advocating for his cause amongst Arab American voters with some effect. Ali Harb is with us today. He's a reporter for Middle East Eye, and he's been covering the Democratic field through the Iowa caucuses and beyond. Ali, welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
And Amr Zahr is here, too. He's a comedian, writer, and law professor who recently published a really interesting essay that we're going to talk about today about why Bernie merits a look from Arab American voters. And we should say he is a national surrogate for Bernie Sanders 2020. Amr, thanks for making some time.
My pleasure.
Ali, I wanted to start with you. What were folks saying at the Iowa caucuses about Bernie? I understand that there were actually two mosques that were serving as official caucus sites.
Mm-hmm. In Des Moines, there were five mosques that were serving as caucus sites, and at the mosques, all of the caucus goers were Arabs and Muslims. At the mosque that I was at, every single voter, I mean everyone, with the exception of two or three voters, went for Bernie Sanders, which was an overwhelming show of support. And when I spoke to caucus goers, why Bernie Sanders? A theme that emerged was the justice aspect. This is a man who calls for justice, and Islam calls for universal values of justice, so we are backing him. But I've been covering this since 2016, and if you want to dissect the phenomenon of Arab Americans for Bernie, I think we should start with the fact that many young people are backing Bernie Sanders. That 18 to 35 demographic is overwhelmingly supportive of the senator. And Arab Americans are a young population in this country. So you see a draw towards his campaign from young Arab Americans who are more politically involved than the older Arab American generation. There is also foreign policy. There's also domestic policies, healthcare, student debt. But I think another factor is that Arab Americans have been a marginalized community in American politics. So they look at Bernie Sanders as an outsider, and they sort of identify with that. And not to say that all Arab Americans support Bernie Sanders. The Arab American community is politically and religiously diverse, and there are activists and advocates who are Arab Americans supporting all kinds of candidates, some even supporting President Trump.
Right. Well, this certainly resonates. I mean, going back to 2016, Bernie Sanders was picking up interest from a lot of younger voters, African-American voters who'd heard what he'd had to say about Black Lives Matter. And if I'm remembering right, wasn't Bernie Sanders somebody who in Michigan was making a point of going out and meeting with Arab-American groups when Hillary Clinton's campaign was not?
Absolutely. I mean, he did two rallies in Dearborn, Michigan. He met with Arab American activists and advocates days before the primaries. He ran ads in Arabic. And that's something that the Bernie Sanders campaign is doing. It's meeting people where they are. It's speaking people's literal and political language. In Iowa, before caucus day, there were Bernie Sanders volunteer waiting outside the mosque to tell people to come on caucus for the senator.
Now that's drilling down, yeah.
Yeah, that's a strength that the Sanders campaign has. After the Nevada caucus, many Latinx advocates went on national television were saying, don't take our vote for granted, and Senator Sanders did not. He came into our communities and he spoke to us. And I think the senator's doing the same thing with the Arab American community.
Right.
The Arab American community is very diverse. We should be careful not to conflate the terms Arab and Muslim. So half of the Arab American community in America is Christian. In fact, in Michigan, perhaps half of them as well are Christian. We don't know for sure because we don't have all these numbers. But the largest Arab American community, the Chaldean, Iraqi, Roman Catholic community, is Christian. We have huge amounts of Lebanese, Palestinian, and Syrian Christians here. And they have the same sort of political alignments for the most part, especially when it comes to foreign policy and social issues, as their Arab Muslim counterparts. And remember, most Muslims in America are not Arab. The largest Muslim population in America is the African American Muslim population. So sometimes we talk about these two communities because there is a lot of similarities, but we have to be careful not to completely conflate the terms Arab and Muslim.
Amer, you wrote an essay that appeared last weekend in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, no less, explaining why Arab American voters, in your view, need to give Bernie Sanders a look. First, I have to ask, did you pitch to them or did they approach you?
They approached me.
Well, can you make a short version of the case that you laid out in the essay?
Well, I'm Palestinian, so Israelis approach me all the time. But sometimes nicely, sometimes not so nicely. But look, my essay was not about necessarily about why Arab Americans should give Bernie Sanders a second look. We're already squarely with the senator for the most part. My essay was more about explaining to the world why Arab Americans are supporting Bernie Sanders. So in 2016, Dearborn overwhelmingly went for Bernie Sanders, especially the Arab-heavy precincts of East Dearborn. They went something like 3-1 for Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton. Now, that happened because of a lot of what Ali was saying. That campaign brought people into our community. They brought field directors, political directors in, finding organizers. I was one of those people. I eventually became a surrogate for the campaign. So they spoke to us, okay? That's the first step of touching any marginalized community.
Is showing up.
Of course, and especially a community like ours, which has been seen sort of traditionally as toxic to any political campaign. Now we are being seen as an asset. Remember, in 2000, Hillary Clinton, when she was running for Senate in New York, took donations from Arab Americans. She got criticized for it. Instead of standing up for those people, she returned the donations. In 2008, of course, Barack Obama was accused of being a Muslim. Well, still till today, he's accused of being a Muslim, as if that sort of thing is disqualifying to become president of the United States. And even he could never bring himself to say, you know, hey, I'm not Muslim, but so what if I were? And now, though, we see, and it really started in 2016 with Bernie Sanders, that we can be a real political asset to any campaign. At the same time, though, we're very loyal. And the Bernie Sanders campaign, as Ali said, aligns with our values, but also they showed up. But when we won Michigan for Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders won Michigan in a very close election in 2016, we took credit for it because, you know, we're Arabs. We like to take credit for everything. And so we invented zero, by the way. I don't know if you know that. A lot of other things.
I do. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Also math.
Math, algebra, coffee, alcohol, deodorant.
All the good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So in any case, we showed up in that campaign for Bernie Sanders and won him Michigan. And the first thing that happened the next day, I even got calls from NPR the next day saying to me, can you explain to us how this Arab American community so squarely and strongly came out for the Jewish candidate? I still get asked these questions today. And of course, that question is so rife. There's so much racism in that one question. Okay, first of all, we're not born anti-Semitic. We're not genetically predisposed to be anti-Semitic. You know, and I ask these reporters, why are you asking me that question? They say, well, you guys have been fighting over there for hundreds of years. I said, well, that's not true. That's not true either. You know, so I mean, we deal with these misconceptions all the time. So a point of my essay there was to say, look, we don't look at Bernie Sanders' Jewishness and say to ourselves, oh, we have to get over that before we support him. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We look at Bernie Sanders' Jewishness as sort of an asset, sort of something that connects us to him more. He's the child of immigrants. We're all the child of immigrants if we're not immigrants ourselves. Also, being a minority, going through the experiences he talked about growing up in New York City, those are some similar experiences that we're going through in this country today. And so he talks about how his Jewishness brings him to notions of empathy and justice and fighting for the weakest among us. And we feel the same way, whether it's about our faith or even our culture. You know, I said in that article as well, when Bernie Sanders' slogan is not me, us, and he talks about fighting for the weakest among us, and he talks about standing up for somebody you don't know and saying we're all in this together, that's stuff that me and Ali and every Arab American have been hearing from their parents forever. It's nothing new.
We've acknowledged there's a generational thing here. The traditional narrative of Arab American voters in the United States, as well as that of a lot of older Jewish voters, is that they lean Republican and that generationally Bernie Sanders might be a tough sell for them. If they consider him not necessarily a friend of Wall Street, if they're thinking about pocketbook issues, if they're comfortable with their health plans, and Bernie Sanders is a candidate who's promising to shake things up.
Well, I would push back on that a little bit. I don't think that pattern holds as strongly in our community. I can't speak for other communities, but I can't say that that pattern holds. We have a lot of sort of generational overlap in the support for Bernie Sanders. A lot of that comes from the values that he expresses. A lot of it comes from his views on foreign policy, especially when it comes to stopping aid to the Saudi war on Yemen, or his views, his really revolutionary views, or his rhetoric on the Palestinian-Israeli question. And so these things kind of bring everybody to the table in our community. And so, yeah, of course, we have some Trump supporters, we have some Republicans. But I don't see, for instance, like what we might see in some other communities, the, let's say, intra-Democratic Party generational thing, where you have seen other communities, older voters going to more traditional candidates like Joe Biden.
Older African-American voters, he tends to poll well with them.
Right, but Bernie does very well with young Black voters. In our community, I don't see that. I don't see a Biden push in our community. I don't see a Buttigieg push or Klobuchar push. You know, the only thing you're seeing a little bit is a Bloomberg push because of all the advertising that's going on. But really, I think it overlaps generations when it comes to Bernie support in our community.
Ali Harb, can I bring you to that question? Do you see any of the other candidates making an effort?
I would have to give enormous credit to the Warren campaign and the way they reached out to Arab Americans, at least in Iowa. When I was in Iowa, a lot of folks told me that Warren personally met with some Arab American activists and she won their support. Also here in D.C., where I am based, many Arab American advocates and human rights advocates who are Arab Americans have come out in support of Warren. But I would say that in the Arab American community or amongst Arab American voters, the divide is not generational as much as it is a status one. It's by income. If you make over a certain number, if you are assimilated to the point where your Arabness is more of a heritage than an identity, you tend to go for more centrist or conservative candidates. But as far as the campaigns making a push, I think every candidate wants to win as many votes as possible. So everyone wants to bring in voters, if they're Arab American or not. But that concerted effort, I haven't seen much outside of the Bernie campaign, which has done phenomenally, and to a lesser degree, the Elizabeth Warren campaign.
This month, Bernie Sanders got an endorsement from MGH PAC, which is the biggest Muslim American political action committee in the U.S. Ali, can you remind us what kind of issues MGH tends to be most active on?
I spoke to the CEO of MGH a couple of days ago, the day that they made the announcement, and I asked that exact question. What are the priorities that you based your endorsement on? And he said the priorities of every American in terms of healthcare, education, also foreign policy that prioritizes human rights and justice. And it's a sort of simple answer in that Muslim Americans are not, you know, are not aliens. They want what every other American wants.
You know, there is one question that I think a lot of people who are undecided and looking at the campaign still have on their minds is that maybe they like what Bernie Sanders has to offer and what he's saying, but they've been hearing people on the center and on the right talk about the fact that, well, he can say all those things, but when he gets into office, can they do them? Amer Zard, is there anything to suggest that even just 4 years with Bernie Sanders could completely turn things around on the issues that he's making these huge points on?
Okay, so this is where I put on my surrogate hat and I advocate for the campaign.
Right. Well, just what do you think? I mean, can he do the things he says he will do?
Look, we know that with the signature issue of Medicare for All, a study just came out from Yale that said implementation of Medicare for All, eliminating private insurance, eliminating all the administrative costs that go with, along with that, and fixing prices in a way that makes sense, would save the American system $468 billion a year and save 68,000 lives. That came out of Yale. And so not only will Medicare for All not cost more than what we're doing now, it'll cost less. But to us and what we say in the campaign all the time, this is the issue of priorities. When the other sides are out there advocating, when they're out there advocating for endless war or tax cuts to billionaires, nobody is asking them how they're going to pay for it. And all of a sudden, we come forward with all these social service programs, and they start asking us how we're going to pay for it. It's a priorities question. Of course, we can do it if we want to. It's the same ideas that FDR had, and he was so popular, they had to amend the Constitution so that he couldn't get elected president for the rest of his life.
Even putting aside the money issues, I mean, the Foreign Service has gone through some radical changes in the past 3 years. I mean, can Bernie Sanders do an entire 180 on the things that Donald Trump has put into play? Is it realistic for him to promise that to voters?
Well, especially when it comes to foreign policy and foreign service, the president actually doesn't need to go to Congress for a lot of that stuff. Remember, the president, as we saw with the whole Ukraine thing, the president sets foreign policy basically on his or her own. And so that's why the issues that put us behind Bernie, especially when it comes to Palestine and Yemen, are so critical to us because we know how much effect a president by himself can have on those issues. But I also believe when it comes to the domestic issues of Medicare for All and these other things, look, winning the presidency is a big amount of political capital to take down to Capitol Hill and say, hey, my signature issue was Medicare for All and I won. So maybe some of you should get in line. And Bernie has said also, if there's senators out there that are going to oppose him, he'll go down to their states and he'll campaign for their popular. Look, Medicare for All is a popular program. Medicare, the notion that people don't believe in it is simply not true. And we are out there saying people shouldn't go bankrupt because they get sick and they shouldn't die because they're poor. And guess what? Most Americans agree with that.
Ali Harb, as the days tick off before the Michigan primary, Bernie Sanders obviously has a lot of other hurdles to get through. What primaries on Super Tuesday are you going to be paying most attention to?
I would say Virginia is going to be big because there's a large Arab American community in Northern Virginia. California, the Arab vote could make a difference in California.
Arab Americans are also very heavily involved in politics in Texas and California. And those are the two most delegate-rich states on Super Tuesday. So in elections that we expect might be close, we have a big hand in pushing Bernie Sanders or any other candidate over the edge. Let me say one more thing. The sort of minority journalism that Ali is doing is wildly important in our community. You know, he is telling our story, and there really aren't people out there doing that kind of thing. So it's very important and beneficial to us that he's out there doing that and giving our narrative to the American public.
I'll just say the sort of journalism he's doing is very important for all of those same reasons.
Agreed.
Ali Harp is a reporter for Middle East Eye. You can read his work online and follow him on Twitter. And Amer Zar is a comedian, writer, and law professor. And he is also a surrogate for Bernie Sanders 2020. Guys, thank you both for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you
for having us.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow, Super Tuesday. Do you ever wonder if there will be anything left to vote on by the time Michigan's primary on March 10th rolls around?
But certainly that's been the experience of Michiganders for many election cycles, that by the time the circus comes to town, it's basically over.
We'll explore that a little further while everybody else in the country, it seems, is casting a ballot. Thanks for listening. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow.